This is The Wheelhouse. I'm Max Reese from NBC Connecticut, and I will be replacing John Dankosky, well, this week anyway. You can join the conversation on our website, wnpr.org/thewheelhouse, and you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Our guests this morning, well, are me, Max Reese. I'm the political reporter from NBC Connecticut. I also host Face the Facts with Max Reese, which returns Sunday, March 3rd. Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, at Colin McEnroe, is joining us by phone today. Good morning, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Reese.
Susan Bigelow will be with us momentarily. She's a contributor with CT News Junkie at Whatever Susan. If I said good morning to Susan, I'm sure she'd say good morning back. And finally, to my left, Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror at CT Mirror Paz. Good morning, Paz.
Good morning, Max.
We are just 3 hours away from Governor Ned Lamont's first budget address to lawmakers and to the state. He is tasked with closing a potential $1.5 billion shortfall in the coming fiscal year and a projected $2 billion shortfall the year after that. So he definitely needs new revenue sources. And he's already laid out a few, getting rid of sales tax deductions, new sin taxes on things like vaping and sugary drinks, and of course, tolls. On the campaign trail, Lamont repeatedly said he would propose highway tolls, but for large trucks only. He reiterated that over and over again on the trail, and then in the days after he won.
We're going to focus just on those big tractor-trailer trucks.
But over the weekend, Lamont said he's looked closer at the data, and truck-only tolling would not provide enough cash to pay for transportation upgrades that Connecticut really needs to grow its economy. Governor Lamont used the Twitter machine for the announcement.
I thought about just tolling on tractor-trailer trucks. That would provide some revenues, enough for us to fix some of our roads and bridges, but not enough to upgrade our transportation system to the 21st century.
So now we're talking about two options, one for highway tolls, one for all vehicles. Colin, you've seen these different kinds of budget speeches before in a rollout. How does this tolls shift sound to you?
Well, before I answer that, I just want to say, yes, it certainly is an exciting day. I've got CTN on in my location, and a lot of the legislators are already coming up the red carpet, and the photographers are yelling, what are you wearing? Who are you wearing? And they're all saying, Coles. I think the tolls thing is maybe a symptom of a larger problem. And the problem is this. Can Connecticut's fiscal crisis or Connecticut's fiscal incapacities right now need very practical solutions? But you can't have only practical solutions, and you can't have a philosophy that just boils down to, well, whatever works. Because ultimately you have to go around and ask all kinds of people to do things they don't want to do, whether those things involve paying on a broadening sales tax base or paying tolls or asking the wealthy to do more than they do right now, which doesn't really seem to be very much in the game plan anyway, or asking state employees to do things that they don't, make concessions they don't really legally have to make. In each case, you have to tell everybody why. Here's why. The reason why is because the following, because of this particular message or vision about how everything's going to come together. And I think one of the problems that Ned Lamont has is this seems less like that kind of understood systemic approach to the problems, and it feels more like improv comedy. You know, it's just like name a tax and a percentage, we'll have the audience call out some suggestions, and we'll try to come up with a little mini policy that goes with that. And I don't think that's going to work. I think ultimately he's going to have to explain how he really thinks about all this stuff. And that hasn't happened so far. It might happen today during this speech. I mean, that's what this speech is for. I'll say one last thing, because I know Paz will want to expand on it too, which is, you know, we sort of mislead people by saying, well, this speech is the budget, or it's the budget message or something. This speech is a first offer. You know, it is the beginning of a long series of negotiations. Now, that's sort of good news for Ned Lamont, because I don't think he really has a confirmed enough set of ideas to roll out a completely coherent budget message. But it doesn't matter anyway, because there's going to be a lot of back and forth.
Well, and that's a point well taken, right? Because we're going to get this budget address. We're going to get this budget announcement today. And then what are we going to do for the next 2.5 months? We're going to shred it apart, come up with what's good, what's bad, et cetera. Paz, you did a deep dive kind of behind the scenes about what led to part of this, what some of the reaction was internally. But also, there's a budget component to this. Tolls is not a now solution. It's a multiple years from now solution. So get into some of those parts for me.
Sure. You know, I had a story I did last night that was sort of about how the administration, quite frankly, stumbled in rolling this out. And the administration does not really defend how they presented this reversal. And it was a very odd thing, the idea of dropping an op-ed piece on a Saturday of a long holiday weekend.
On the morning of a holiday weekend.
On the morning of a holiday weekend. And then not being available for questions. Ryan Drazewicz, the chief of staff, did some damage control the next day with a conference call with reporters. But we have not heard directly from the governor, and we will so today. So there's that. Now, there's concern at the Capitol among his allies, not among his enemies, but among his allies, as to whether or not they really have a game plan on tolls and on really how to proceed. So I think there's going to be some pressure on the governor today to reassure people that this is, as Colin said, okay, this is why I'm doing what I'm doing. And by the way, I know how to get what I'm proposing today. And that's the big unanswered question with Ned Lamont. He is a very nice man. He has done a great job of reaching out to lawmakers. He's shown that he is open. He is willing to hear other ideas. But what legislators don't know is, does he have the ability to eventually draw a hard line that, particularly in the House, you know, where Democrats have 90 members and it's a little bit like herding cats, to do it, a budget in the House, you need to play off of a governor. You need to really be able to say this is the line beyond which he will not retreat. And right now, we don't know where that line is. And we, quite frankly, we don't know if there is that line.
Susan Bigelow, number one, you've heard some of these syntax ideas, but also something we've heard from Ryan Drazewicz over the last several days, something Paz alluded to, the difference between governing and campaigning. And now we're getting a rollout. So what do you make of where we are with what some of these proposals look like and perhaps what the next budgeting plan actually looks like?
Yeah, that difference between budgeting, between governing and campaigning does seem it's especially sharp, and it does suggest that the campaign was either very ill-informed or very cynical. And a lot of people are furious at Ned Lamont right now because they think he's a flip-flopper, that he said one thing and then he's going to do something else. And not just members of the public, but state employees who thought there was going to be some sort of win-win solution, which probably doesn't exist.
Right.
But that's what Ned Lamont said during the campaign. And people who thought that there was going to be truck-only tolls, again, a really not a feasible solution, might not even be legal to do that. Rhode Island is having a fight over this right now. But again, people thought, oh, well, that sounds great. I won't have to pay for my tolls. But now it seems, oh, suddenly here we are. Go ahead.
And that point about Rhode Island's truck tolls is well taken. Rhode Island has this truck program. It's being challenged in federal court by the trucking industry there. It's distinctly possible that Connecticut could have gone forward with this. This is not to defend Ned Lamont. It's just speaking practically about this. It's very possible we could have moved forward with this. Then 6 months from now, Connecticut's plan is not feasible. It cannot be done.
Right. Or like worst case scenario, 2 years from now when we're just about ready to roll the thing out, it turns out it won't work. So governing has been more difficult, certainly for Ned Lamont. I agree that the rollout was terrible. It is hard to imagine a good rollout on tolls, but it's also, this just seemed like it was such a clumsy thing to do, and especially to have no follow-up, that was really, really difficult.
And it looks like now we're getting a platter of other ideas. We have a whack tax on vaping, 75%, a sugary drink tax, but also even more union givebacks. I suppose, is he channeling his inner Michael Bloomberg on things like a sugary drink tax? Or, Colin, is Governor Ned Lamont channeling perhaps a Dan Malloy with the way he's trying to change the way pension funds look and how municipalities maybe share some of those costs?
I think he's trying to channel his inner Cheesecake Factory manager. I mean, really, as you said, platter, that's a great word for it. The stuff that's in there right now, it is like a Cheesecake Factory menu. I'll take one of those. Yeah,
I think they all have about 3,000 calories in them, too, something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. So, and I think the real question is, where's the playbook? I'm kind of coming back to my first comment. What is the playbook? What's when you get lost, what do you go back to help you orient yourself? What's your overall, objective here? And I don't think they have one. I also think that one of the reasons for some of the chaotic behavior that Paz was describing is because this is a pretty new team. These guys don't even know each other very well. Ned has known most of his sort of inner circle a matter of months. So, and there isn't anybody there with like the super gray hair who can say, "Hey, Bob, how does that usually work? How do you get that? How do you accomplish that?" And I think in the absence of all that, my suspicion is the closest thing to a playbook they have is the what we sometimes call the Doomsday Commission or whatever, the Patricelli and Smith.
The Fiscal Commission.
I don't even know what it's really called. But anyway, it's this document drafted mainly by a lot of business leaders. It's a document that it was a report on fiscal stability. It emphasized a lot of the things you're seeing now, like broadening the sales tax, doing things that affluent people and businesses would be happy about, and counteracting those or making up for those in areas like the sales tax. And if that's going to be their beacon, they're going to get a lot of resistance from people who did expect the burdens to be shared a little bit differently.
And Paz, you and I have been in the halls of the Capitol last several days talking with people all over. What I've heard from some people is saying, what is going on? Why did they roll out some things like this? Do you think it is an experience issue within the Lamont administration with the way they understand, or for that matter, do not understand the political systems and the machinations the way they exist?
Yeah, there's a couple thoughts on that. One is, yes, I think it does show inexperience. But to be fair, budget rollouts always are a bit unwieldy. The goal of an administration is to get a bunch of things out so on budget day you can focus on your central message and not have everybody chasing around all the little details, or not so little details in many cases. So that is not unique to this administration. But, to Colin's point, yeah, I mean, Dan Malloy came into office with people he had known for years and years and years. He had a fully developed agenda. He had the advantage of Democrats who were so eager to have a Democratic governor. Remember, it had been since Bill O'Neill left office in 1991 since they had a Democratic governor. So Malloy had a lot of energy going for him. Even though he won with less than 50% of the vote, he really was able to do a lot those first 2 years, and then it got harder going forward. Ned Lamont's in a different place. The Democrats now, okay, we know how to deal with a Democratic governor. We're not blown away by that. They want him to succeed, but he faces, I think, a legislature that's a little bit more aggressive than Dan Malloy faced in his first 2 years.
Susan, we are only months removed from an election where more than 600,000 people, roughly-ish, liked what Bob Stefanowski was saying about cutting the income tax, whether it was feasible, which it was not, or not, and the idea of getting cost of living down. And now you have a governor who's already kind of targeted organized labor in a certain respect, many of his allies, but also we have other taxes going on. What are you hearing then? what is the message that you're hearing from Ned Lamont?
I'm hearing a message that is incoherent, unfortunately. There's something for everybody to hate in this budget. There's tolls and there's sales tax increases. Exemptions from exemptions, I suppose. It's they're removing sales tax
the
exemptions
stuff that,
from things.
There's a whole lot of stuff that's now going to get sales tax
exactly,
under this idea.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But there's also things like talking about like the repealing the estate tax. For instance,
right.
Which is something progressives they hate the idea of doing this, because if you are going after organized labor and you are putting a regressive tax, which affects everybody, but does fall hardest on the poor who can least afford it, like tolls, for example, that's regressive. If you're doing something like that, but also taking away a progressive tax on the rich, that's something that the left absolutely hates. So there's something here in this particular budget that's going to make everybody in the legislature angry. And Ned Lamont is not giving us a lot of reasons to like it.
Susan, you made a point that there's a lot of stuff in there that people are going to hate. Does that mean some of it's medicine? Does that mean there's just some stuff that the state has to swallow just because of, to use Mark Pazniok's colleague Keith Faniff's phrase, the sins of the past, you now need the medicine of the future, which unfortunately are some of these taxes to get the fiscal house in order?
Yeah, absolutely. Tolls, we have to do them. And we've known for a long time. Mm-hmm. We have to do them. We all kind of figured, people who understand this stuff, everyone figured Ned Lamont was going to have to get here at some point. The fact that he's rolling out tolls is not a surprise to anybody. But that means everybody was ready with their attacks in them as well. It's medicine. It's things that we have to do. Talking to organized labor about give backs, about some sort of pension reform, something like that, that's stuff we have to do. But he's not really framing it this way yet. He's not saying this is something that we have to do because there's a better future waiting for us if we do. It's just sort of coming out haphazardly here and there as just sort of little Band-Aids and things like that.
Paz. One of the things that's new in what he's trying to do, and some of it is symbolic, some of it is real dollars, but he is trying to change the benefit package for current retirees,
right,
to a relatively small degree. He's talking about the cost of living allowances, adjustments, that instead of pegging them to inflation and having a minimum increase, really, that's the way it's worked for years, of having what they call shared risk. Sorry, we're going to peg this to how well the pension fund is doing in the markets. So it's not a huge change, but it is.
It's a change.
It's a cultural change. It's a very strong message to current retirees. Again, they're not talking about cutting pensions, anything that draconian, which of course would be legally problematic to say the least. But it is new. It is an area in which Lamont is throwing a marker down. And now it'll be interesting to see how he pursues it and how persuasive he is with labor and the general public.
Colin, I give you the final word on this. We've already heard from organized labor saying you've gone to the well with us twice on this. Why on earth are you coming back to us again? Do you expect organized labor to play ball in the least? Or do we see perhaps an extended CBAC agreement to 2030, maybe even beyond?
Well, I mean, their initial position is this is a non-starter. And I think they need to see a lot of other pieces on the board before they'll have that conversation. I mean, obviously, to your point, reopening the agreement is something that they will only do if they can see some pretty obvious gains that they can make. They're not going to open the agreement or reopen the agreement just so they can lose things. But I think the larger point, I just want to come back to something that Susan said, which is that there's something for everybody to hate, which I essentially agree with, the exception really being the richest citizens of Connecticut, the wealthiest citizens of Connecticut. If there's something in here for them to hate, I mean, I don't see it. They want to get rid of the estate tax. Well, I think they're probably going to get that, or there's certainly a lot of moves being made to do that. They don't want the highest bracket to go up. It doesn't look like that's going to happen either. If there's one thing that Ned Lamont seems to be sticking to right now, is that the people like him, the kind of people that he knows, are not going to be asked to do a tremendous amount more. And then to go back to your question, Max, I think it's hard to go to estate employees or anybody else for that matter and say, well, here, you guys have got to do your part if, in fact, they don't see any pain on in that particular sector.
We are going to have a break coming up next. We will talk about Amazon and General Electric. Connecticut got bashed big time when GE announced it was moving its headquarters from Fairfield to Boston. But how's GE looking these days? This is The Wheelhouse. Last week, an earthquake shook the Northeast. You may not have felt it, because it was an economic development earthquake. Both General Electric and Amazon announced they would pull back on plans to greatly expand their workforces in two of the region's largest cities. General Electric said it would not be building a much-hyped 12-story office tower in Boston's booming Seaport District and will sell property instead. Amazon, meanwhile, scrapped a multi-year, even more hyped decision to site one of the tech giant's two North American headquarters in Long Island City in Queens, New York. Let's start with Amazon. Amazon in killing its proposed $2.5 billion campus in Long Island City. It has ignited some cautious optimism among those looking to grow Connecticut's economy, including Governor Ned Lamont. Amazon essentially ignored numerous Connecticut proposals when it picked finalists of its HQ2 competition. We didn't even crack the top 20. So what does this say about Lamont and lessons he may or may not have learned from his predecessor in trying to lure giant corporations like Amazon to expand in Connecticut? Susan Bigelow, I'll start with you.
He's learned he has to be, he has to jump on these things fast. Whether or not Amazon cares, I
That's
doubt
a good
it.
Point.
I doubt it. This whole situation is fascinating because the reasons why Amazon is pulling out is because of local opposition, and that local opposition has been getting bashed in the press, and people can't understand, especially from a Connecticut perspective, we can't understand why they're leaving 25,000 jobs on the table. But that local opposition has to do with how things are in New York right now. People are struggling with high rents. They're struggling with gentrification, and it was thought that the Amazon headquarters would make that situation much, much, much worse. Trying to invite them to come to Connecticut, stay in Stamford, for example, be in New York without being in New York and having to deal with that kind of pressure, I hope it's attractive to Amazon. That'd be great. It would be a game changer. But it doesn't seem like Amazon is interested in a place like this. They are interested in places like New York, like Boston, like their home in Seattle. So it's good to see at least Ned Lamont trying. Whether or not that gets anywhere, I have no idea.
Have you ever been to Queens?
Queens is lovely.
It's a wonderful place.
My dad had a place. My dad had a place in Flushing Meadows, if I'm not mistaken. But Paz, there was polling that said that the residents like this. You had rallies after the fact. You had people saying it's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's fault. It's all these other people's fault. What on earth could we learn from something like this when, you know, you have a governor making a decision like this with some local politicians, but then the whole thing falls apart?
Yeah, and it was one of the few things that Cuomo and de Blasio agreed on. maybe there's a lesson there. Don't agree. I would not reach too far in drawing lessons from this. I don't think this is the game changer that some people think it is, saying that, okay, people are going to finally wake up and they're going to stop paying corporate blackmail to attract these companies. I think this is situational. New York does not need this in the way that other places do. The numbers of this deal, even though it was like a $3 billion package, the numbers of the deal seemed to actually work in New York's favor, that over the long haul, they were going to get far more.
Like $27 billion in economic impact, if I'm not mistaken.
But again, the politics and the optics were just god-awful. You know, giving one of the richest companies owned by the richest man in the world $3 billion in public funds, that does not sit well. Those types of deals have not sat well in Connecticut and elsewhere. But here's the thing. You know, in Connecticut, people will say, oh, every time Connecticut does an incentive, it's evidence of how bad a place Connecticut is to do business. There is some truth to about complaints about Connecticut's business climate. However, if you look at these incentives nationally, they are paid everywhere. This is the game. Boeing got something like $13 million in the last 15 years, including from places like Alabama.
Yes.
You know.
Economic incentives are never going away, it looks like. This is the game now, whether you like it or not. Airbus got them for Alabama. Boeing got it for both Chicago and for South Carolina. And Colin, as long as this is the game, how do you think Connecticut competes when it comes to getting, whether it's an Amazon, whether it's another giant corporation that says, I'm looking for a new home?
Right. Well, first of all, I agree. The economic incentives are not going to go away. But you can't do it. You usually can't do it with economic incentives alone, because then you wind up with kind of a race to the bottom where your state government is so cheap that it doesn't cost very much in taxes. Well, you start sacrificing things at a certain point, and some of those things are meaningful to businesses that may want to relocate. And so if I were Connecticut, and I wanted to derive some kind of lesson from this, I would start with the idea of kind of really understanding what it's like to use services in your state. And I'll give a specific suggestion. So the point people for this particular idea of bringing Amazon to Connecticut are Jim Smith, who's the former president of Webster Bank, former chairman of Webster Bank maybe even, and then the former PepsiCo chairwoman and CEO who's now retired. I'm guessing these people don't use the Stamford train station a lot. I'm guessing that they either have Mercedes or they have somebody driving them around. My suggestion to everybody involved in this is go take the train a few times from Stamford. And if Stamford is going to be the linchpin of a case like this, why don't you figure out what it would be like for the average Amazon employee to work in Stamford, commute there from someplace else? How does this state really work? Because I don't think it's a particularly effective technique to have people who aren't living the lives of a typical Amazon employee or whatever company it is you're trying to lure there, to have those people trying to construct the case. You need to understand, first of all, what the real strengths and liabilities of your own state are. And I'm guessing that if you walked, 100 Amazon executives through the Stamford train station, they go, oh, no, we're not coming here.
I'll add one more thing to that, Colin. We have a protracted landscape when it comes to economic developers. You have, I would probably bet there's over 100 to 120, maybe even 130 different people in cities and towns handling economic development that do not want to share Amazon with anybody. Mm-hmm. That you have cities and towns saying, no, this should be ours. And then you have other counties and things like that all over the country that are saying, well, no, we're going to share this revenue and it's going to be all right. Is that a part of this, too, that, we're a state that has a system that's kind of hard to bring one company in like that, or no?
Well, I mean, there was all sort of the Fairfield to Greenwich corridor argument.
Because that was the Malloy pitch. That was the one that was Malloy supported, right?
But that you sort of look at that Gold Coast as a corridor. And that's probably a more effective thing to do, just the way that Connecticut is set up right now. I mean, just the land size that you're talking about is so small.
Paz, I want to move on to General Electric now to talk about what is it that Boston really got. There's a lot of people in the Capitol saying, I told you so right now about General Electric, when they had just about zero insight into what was going on inside the company a number of years ago. What do you make of General Electric scaling back in a huge way up in Boston?
Schadenfreude is one of my favorite words. And
there's a lot of that going on right now.
Yes. To me, GE was not the right case study about what was wrong with Connecticut's business climate. GE basically does not pay taxes, right? They are the best company in
well
the world
documented
at avoiding the payment of taxes. So, okay, so let's set that aside. They were in a 1970s suburban office park. Those have fallen out of favor. So the reasons they went to Boston really were not the reaction to Connecticut that people wanted to make it out to be. Now, you layer onto that, yes, people have taken great joy in the fact that, the Wall Street Journal did this incredible takedown of them, pointing out that under Jeff Immelt, who lectured Connecticut about its unfunded pension liability, that while Jeff Immelt ran GE, they went from a fully funded pension to a woefully underfunded.
A not funded pension.
Yeah. And so, again, I don't know what lessons you can draw. Yes, let's be honest. There is some joy in Connecticut to watch that company go to Boston and stumble around. Boston is going to, it looks like they will be made whole as far as the mm-hmm. incentives they gave them. They're going to give the money back. Boston did purchase some land for them, but, let's face it, that land has real value. So Boston yeah. presumably can find another buyer.
Susan?
Yeah, I think that if there's a lesson to be learned from both the Amazon and the GE fiasco, it's that big companies want to go to big, exciting cities. And it's going to be very hard for Connecticut, even with all of the tax incentives in the world, even with, we'll give you free land in, say, Stonington or Enfield or whoever. That's not going to be nearly as attractive as going to somewhere like Boston or New York, just because of that's what that's what people who have, that's what their talent wants. They want to go to a place like that where they can live in that urban environment, because that's what young professionals are looking for. And we don't have that here. We don't have that system yet. We don't have a big city. We don't have great transportation. We don't have those amenities here. It's very hard for us to compete unless we look at developing those in some way.
Paz, you're going to chime in.
Yeah, I mean, there are tech companies that have developed in Connecticut. And, you know, the former CEO of one told me the other day that the advantage was of not being in Silicon Valley is you're not competing with the Googles of the world and Facebooks of the world and whatnot. And you can build smaller tech centers. You know, we're seeing it, hopefully, with Infosys, a tech company that just relocated or just opened a new hub in downtown Hartford. So there are chances to build on these things. When it comes down to Stanford, it's really a throwback to the 70s. It's, okay, companies, we're going to give you proximity to New York City. And remember, in the 70s, when a lot of those companies came to Connecticut or went to New Jersey, it was because Manhattan seemed to be circling the toilet. You know, the city was on the verge of bankruptcy. Crime was sky high. It was just, you know, it seemed like an awful, awful place for the foreseeable future. And that's, Connecticut benefited from that. Now it's different. New York is booming, but it's booming so much that not every company can go into Manhattan. So Connecticut hopes once again to profit on its proximity to New York City.
Colin, I want to frame part of it this way. What do you think the big difference is today compared to 3 years ago? Because it felt like the political world was ending here in Connecticut when General Electric announced it was going to be leaving. And what I can't help but wonder is, what would the reaction be today if they actually stayed, to what the state's program is to keep a company? So what do you make of where General Electric is now, but also where Connecticut is now in those 3 years since?
Well, I mean, 3 years ago, I thought, as many of us did, that the catastrophe was being overhyped. And, you know, just to build on what Paz was just saying, you can start a llama ranch, but you can't start a brontosaurus ranch, because the brontosauruses are going to break out of the containment on the first day and go lumbering off wherever they're going to go. And so if you want to have a growing economy and a nifty opportunistic economy, you have to think a little bit smaller, the way Paz was suggesting. And, you know, I mean, GE had already decided what it was going to do and just went off and did it. The other part of this is, and I think this is a really important lesson that we forget, is because when we talk about government and business in opposition to one another, there's always this assumption that business is really smart. Business is smart, and business is streamlined, and businesses know what they're doing. And that's often not the case. My philosophy, Groucho Marx used to sign off some of his letters to his brothers by saying, always inspect the dice. And that's kind of how I feel about these companies, too. I mean, we assumed that GE was this, you know, this very vital company surging forward into the future. But, I mean, companies that kind of pump up their value and pay out some quickie bonuses on the basis of that and then confess some of their problems later, that's a very typical scenario in American government. You can't assume, in American business, you can't assume that you know what's happening with a company. And with these old companies, they often do have these not very well understood long-term problems. And so I'm a little bit more in the Pazniokas camp, you know. I mean, create an environment where the startups will come and hope that you will pick more winners than losers.
You are listening to The Wheelhouse on WNPR. I'm guest host Max Reese from NBC Connecticut, joined by Mark Pazniokas, The Connecticut Mirror, Susan Bigelow of CT News Junkie, and of course, Colin McEnroe of The Colin McEnroe Show. I want to shift gears quickly to one final topic for this segment, at least. On Tuesday, State Attorney General William Tong announced Connecticut is one of 16 states suing the Trump administration to block the diversion of military construction funds to build walls along the U.S.-Mexico border. Susan, I want to begin with you. This feels like an awfully Blumenthalian move, perhaps, by our new attorney general. Do you see it that way as well?
Sort of. Although this is sort of what he said he was going to do.
Without a doubt, this is a campaign promise.
This is exactly what he said he was going to do. This is going to be a popular move. Everyone's going to like it. But yeah, it does feel like it's a little more, like you said, it's very Blumenthalian. It's high profile. It's going to get him in front of the cameras. Great. That there's so many other states in this, though, that he's not going to get like a lot of attention for it nationally, but he'll get attention for it here. This is a good move for any Democratic attorney general, I think, at this point, because that wall is very unpopular. The move that the declaration of an emergency is very unpopular. Then this lawsuit probably has at least some traction.
Paz, do we think that this is what we could expect from William Tong? Or do we also think that the state may in fact have some legal standing, even though we are nowhere nearly perhaps as impacted as maybe a state like California when it comes to a lawsuit like this?
I am guessing that William Tong will be somewhere between Dick Blumenthal and George Jepson as far as the publicity scale.
To 100, if you will.
George wasn't zero, but yeah, it's
maybe a seven.
Maybe
10.
A seven. One of the ironies of this lawsuit is, you know, they'd be doing the Republicans a huge favor because there are plenty of Republicans who are horrified by this. You have many conservative commentators pointing out correctly that, this is a Republican president doing this. What does the next president, perhaps a Democrat, mm-hmm. do if this precedent is set?
Right. Climate change, gun control. We're
sure.
The examples are many.
President Kamala Harris, what's her idea of emergency?
Right.
And
President Bernie Sanders.
President Bernie Sanders. So, this is not a surprise. Attorney General George Jepson also sued the Trump administration. He participated in these kinds of things. He just had a little different style than Dick Blumenthal, who was the extreme example of being out front all the time. I mean, look, this is everybody understands that in Connecticut. Dick Blumenthal himself teases, will poke fun at himself over it because he knows it's just part of his DNA. And we'll see, what this signifies about William Tong and how aggressive he'll be.
Colin, do you expect Attorney General William Tong to be in the conversations with those litigious states like New York, like California, taking on the Trump administration at not necessarily every turn, but the moment that they see something they don't like?
I do not expect the William Tong that I know to sit out landmark battles. I think he's a guy who, first of all, enjoys being in the fray, enjoys being a part of the conversation. I guess one question I have is, if these attorneys general make things really hot for Trump and his emergency declaration, I wonder if he'll seek outside help from Jepson and Perry Zinn-Rothorn, the former AG, because they're at Shipman Goodman now. They've just started this new attorney general's unit where these former attorney generals will help you beat current attorney generals. So who knows? Maybe George Jepson will be retained to help in the fight against people like William Tong. I'm kidding, I hope. Just very quickly, this kind of thing was never meant to be worked out in the courts. The actual National Emergency Act, which was drafted right after Watergate, the plan was that Congress could effectively veto a presidential emergency declaration by a joint resolution. And the courts changed that all around. So now, you do have this situation where you're going to courts, you're possibly creating a precedent of one type or another. But I will say this, should be kind of a layup. I mean, even just based on all of the material that President Trump, as usual, has handed his opponents. At the time of announcing this national emergency, he said, I could do the wall over a longer period of time. I didn't need to do this.
He instantly equivocated on this.
Yeah.
Instantly.
He said, I'd rather do it much faster. Well, I'd rather do it much faster does not translate well to emergency.
And we are going to take a break. Coming up next, we're going to look at a new FBI probe happening in Bridgeport. Are the boys back in town? Is it just like old times? This is The Wheelhouse on WNPR. This is The Wheelhouse. I am Max Reese from NBC Connecticut, host of Face the Facts with Max Reese, which comes back March 3rd. And I am replacing John Dankosky for about 10 more minutes. You can join the conversation on our website, WNPR.org/thewheelhouse, and you can join us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Once again, I'm Max Reese, NBC Connecticut. I'm joined by phone with Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Susan Bigelow, contributor to CT News Junkie at Whatever Susan, and Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror at CT Mirror Paz. We received some tweets to our segment about the proposed benefit changes from Governor Ned Lamont that we're expecting to hear from in his first budget address in about 2.5 hours, roughly. Kate R. responded, the proposed COLA change is a good one and not nearly as awful as unions made it out to be last night. They should take it. And of course, we hearing also from the unions themselves, AFT Connecticut, saying how they swiftly and strongly are they say the administration should instead focus efforts on working together to protect retirement security. So we expect to hear much more about that in the coming days and weeks if the state's going to make changes or at least make proposals to benefits to state employees. Moving on, the feds are back to issuing subpoenas again in the city of Bridgeport, this time as part of a criminal probe into scrap metal sales involving the city's public facilities department. Colin, should some folks who have had experience with the FBI be worried again in the city of Bridgeport?
Well, first of all, I love Bridgeport, and I don't know whether my fellow panelists would agree with me, but I think it's really hard for those of us who kind of cover the state to just sort of jump in and cover Bridgeport. Bridgeport is so different and has a culture that is so tightly enmeshed, and all the stories go back one or two or three generations, and there are all these hatreds and stuff. But looking at what's happening there, yeah, it all started with a mysterious anonymous letter last fall talking essentially about how something was going on with the city's use of scrap, disposal of scrap metal, that there might have been some kind of cash fund and by which scrap metal was gotten rid of, but where did the money go? And since then, yeah, it seems to be ballooning. It seems to be expanding. And, of course, the other thing that's kind of hilarious about Bridgeport is that despite all of its legal problems, like, nobody has more law enforcement or quasi-law enforcement around. So, yeah, the FBI is involved, but Mayor Ganim has also decided that he needs to hire some kind of corporate detectives. I think he may have hired Remington Steele. I'm not 100% sure about that. But so he hired Remington Steele, but he's also got this guy on staff who, I don't know, maybe one of the other panelists could explain this better, but it was the FBI agent who was kind of in charge of bringing Joe Ganim down back in the old days, who, you know, went onto the other side and is a big believer in Joe Ganim now. And I don't exactly know what his job is in the Bridgeport government, but he's kind of there. He's just kind of making sure, yeah, maybe his job is to watch Joe and make sure Joe doesn't slip back to the dark side. But so there's a lot of eyes on this problem.
And in the movies, that's known as meeting cute.
a meet cute.
Yeah.
Paz, off mic, you made a point about this. Scrap metal isn't quite the sexiest investigation in the world, but you don't want the plastic jackets walking around.
Yeah, you don't know where it goes, but it's far different. I mean, let's just go there. I mean, the reason we're talking about this is that the current mayor of Bridgeport spent a long time in a federal facility for corruption. But when Joe Ganim engaged in corruption years ago, he went big. You know, there was not.
It was more of a movie script than this.
Yes. And he basically had a payment plan. If you want to do business in the city of Bridgeport, this is what it cost. And it was pretty much across the board. And so this, it certainly feels a lot different. Joe Ganim has been quick to bring on more compliance oversight, which is a smart thing politically, probably legally as well. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see where it goes. But it just certainly at this point feels far different than what toppled Joe Ganim the first time around.
And, Susan, that's perhaps an okay segue. Joe Ganim is up for re-election this year. And what do you make of another FBI investigation going on? But also, what do we make of Joe Ganim's perhaps re-election chances against a sitting member of the Connecticut State Senate?
Right. I think his chances are actually pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, Bridgeport just loves the guy. They're always going to love this guy. Apparently, no matter what he does, they're going to be on his side. I I don't see that this is going to be a problem for him. It doesn't seem to have anything to do with him.
Seems completely removed from the mayor's office,
right,
is what
I mean,
it feels like.
And who in their lives has not dealt a little scrap metal to someone here and there? I mean, it's okay.
Just some scrap metal.
Sure, it's nothing. It's just a little thing. But no, I don't think it's going to be a problem for him at all. I think that he's going to do very well. I think that something's going to have to happen. A big thing is going to have to happen to him or to the city for people to turn away from him.
Colin, do we think that Joe Ganim, first of all, his political comeback is really the stuff of a legend. You can't really argue with that. He came back and also the city's budget was put on relatively stable ground shortly after he went in and replacing Bill Finch. Colin, what do you make of the Joe Ganim era in Bridgeport? And does it seem like it's going to continue even with a Democratic primary fight against Marilyn Moore?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with everybody who's saying that Joe probably doesn't have that much to worry about. This is a real machine town. Mario Testa is the political boss of this town. Joe Ganim is his guy. And this affects your ability to raise money for political campaigns against Joe Ganim. Very difficult thing to do. Raising money for Joe Ganim, fairly easy thing to do. In terms of sort of how Bridgeport is functioning, I guess that's, I mean, not for election purposes, but, you know, if in fact this scrap metal thing goes on and it turns out that there's a pervasive problem here and that it's not just scrap metal, it's people who want to be on the receiving end of some things, doing special favors for people who are inside the government, if there's a way in which this, as seems quite possible, I might add, but if this expands to kind of demonstrate a government that still isn't even close to resembling, you know, a clean government. I mean, that's going to be a black mark against Joe Ganim. But I just have to assume you could put up a YouTube video proving that Joe Ganim is torturing baby penguins in his basement.
Pat, go ahead and jump in.
The counterargument is Joe Ganim, 10 minutes after the city, the people of Bridgeport returned him to office, he grew bored and looked at running for governor. And
right.
there may be a price to pay for that. Marilyn Moore, who is seeking the Democratic nomination against him, is a very tough player. She has never won with the backing of the city organization. So, again, I'm always reluctant to opine about Bridgeport from a distance. Although I will say the first Democratic town committee meeting I ever covered down there many years ago, I witnessed a fist fight between Mario Testa, the current.
That's a my kind of DTC.
The current Democratic chairman and a guy named Mike Rizzitelli. But, you know, Joe and Mario seem to be at odds right now. Mario, you know, as reported by the Connecticut Post, was furious that Joe removed somebody from this facility without consulting with Mario. So, you know, who knows? There's always a lot of stuff swirling there, and there are subplots, and you never know which one is going to really catch fire and take over the dynamic of a race.
Let's move on to our final segment, airing of grievances and the feats of strength. Susan Bigelow, any grievances to air, any feats of strength to discuss?
All right. My feat of strength is that we have adopted two new cats.
Mazel tov.
Yes, thank you. This is in addition to the three cats that we already have. So, you know,
60% increase. It's
yeah,
very impressive.
This is absolutely well into crazy cat lady territory. That's okay.
The first step is admitting it, though. Is that correct?
We have a problem. That's all right. We got these cats from Mary's Kitty Corner in Granby. They're really great rescue. But these cats have been tearing apart the house and finding ways to do things to our doors and the things we're trying to do to contain them that we never thought possible. But so far, so good. So that's my feat of strength.
Good. Colin McEnroe, feats of strength, airing of grievances.
These would be feats of strength. I'm going to just call people's attention to two different documentaries about African-American singers. One of them is the one that's about Sam Cooke that's on Netflix right now and shows a dimension to Sam Cooke, a political dimension to Sam Cooke that I hadn't grasped anyway, and I thought I knew something about Sam Cooke. And then last night, PBS aired an absolutely amazing documentary about Sammy Davis Jr., who I really regard as the most grievously underestimated American entertainer of the 20th century. This is a guy who probably had more talent in his body than anybody performing in America during that period, but also had a lot of struggles. And this is just a terrific documentary. I'm sure we'll re-air it, but I mean, if you can even just watch it online, do so.
Mark Pazniokas.
My grievance is Clarence Thomas and his desire to rewrite libel laws, and he is seeming to suggest that it would be a good thing to allow the criminal prosecution of libel. He seems to be siding with President Trump, who certainly has been complaining that it's way too hard for public officials to sue for libel.
I'm going to end on a lighter note. My son is nearly walking, a feat of strength, and my daughter is now climbing. So this is very exciting stuff in the Reese household. The Wheelhouse is produced by Scott Breedy. Our executive producer is Katie Talarski. Kyone Wolf is the technical producer. Thank you to intern Kayla Thomas and to Carlos Mejia and Ryan Karen King for putting together a very clever promo on my hosting gig. And a special thank you to everyone here at Connecticut Public Radio for inviting me, Max Reese, of NBC Connecticut, to sit in for the irreplaceable John Dankosky. This is Max Reese, NBC Connecticut, today for WNPR. Have a great Wednesday.